Welcome to the podcast of Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church, located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. LBIC is a community being transformed by the love of Jesus, sharing this love with all people. We want this podcast to be an extension of our community and a connection with familiar voices. Together, we want to think about how to follow Jesus in our particular moment. So enjoy the podcast. We're grateful to have you join us as a part of the LBIC family.
God has raised this Jesus your witnesses coming. So let's backtrack a little bit and start with verse 22, when Peter says this, "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles and wonders and signs which God did among you through him, as you yourselves." Verse 22 tells us something very important about humanity, about you and about me. Here it is. We're fickle people. We are fickle people. Jesus shows up in signs and wonders and miracles. He's doing good things. He's healing people. He's giving people place in society. He's giving women and children a place that they didn't have before. He's doing good things. But we're fickle people. We think we know what we want, but then when the good shows up and is actually done in front of us and to us and with us, we're like, oh, is that it? I'm not so sure anymore. We're a fickle people. Verse 22 demonstrates this. Jesus performs these signs and these miracles partly to demonstrate the heart of God, partly to demonstrate God's nature, the nature of God's kingdom, and partly to prove that he was the Messiah. But this goodness of heart that communicates the heart of God to humanity was rejected and was confronted the evil of human hearts. The grace of God in the person of Jesus revealed the darkness and the sin of human hearts. The crucifixion is what humanity does to the good. Crucifixion is what humanity does to the good. This happens in the historical person of Jesus. We also see this happening in our day and our time as well. We can think we want the best and the good for somebody else until that encroaches on our good. And then when it begins to encroach on our good, we're like, oh, I'm not sure I'm as passionate about that anymore. And so when our good is sacrificed, we're like, I'm not so sure I want that, but when I can absorb the good, we're all for it. But when Jesus confronts the hearts of Pharisees and the people and the systems, the religious systems, they don't want anything to do with it. They say they want the Messiah. They say they want the Messiah to come and to do what the Messiah thought the Messiah should do. But when the Messiah shows up, they're like, I'm not so sure. I really want any part of that. And so they crucify the good. The unredeemed world, apart from the resurrection of Jesus, apart from the person and the resurrection of Jesus, can never do good on its own. It's always going to be contingent on something else. There is no essence, there is no origin, apart from the goodness of God revealed in the person of Jesus Christ, that can define for us what good is. It is only in the person of Jesus that we have a center for what good is. All other good, apart from Jesus, lies really in what is good for us, and whether it suits us and when it suits us. But in the person of Jesus, Jesus defines for us what good is. And through him, we can flourish on our own weakness. N.T. Wright describes what's happening here in this way, in the crucifixion of Jesus, the Messiah. He says, "The anointed king will come to the place where evil was reaching its height." So you have this escalation of evil of the religious systems, with the escalation of the evil of the violence of Rome, where this accumulated evil would blow itself out in one great act of unwarranted violence against the person who, of all, had done nothing to deserve it. This doesn't for a moment justify our wickedness. Rather, it declares that God, knowing how powerful that wickedness was, had long planned to nullify its power by taking its course upon himself. And the person who was silent, the man whom God would be loved. So returning to this question a few minutes ago, how much does God know? There's this phrase in verse 23. "This man Jesus was handed over to you," here's the phrase, "by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge." Now, God in this sense, it's Father, Son, and Spirit. So this isn't just like, oh, Father has dreamed up this plan, and oh, here, Jesus, this is what you're going to do. All three of them are in it. So, was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him on the cross. So that's the phrase, God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. Now, sometimes in philosophical there is something that we can determine by this phrase, what Peter is saying and proclaiming here. Before all creation, this is what I think is clear, before all creation, God knew that it would cost God his own self by creating the way that he did. Before God even created, he knew that in creating the way he did, it was going to cost God everything. God knew, God accepted, and God anticipated his own suffering from the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. The Creator from the beginning knew and allowed all of history to work towards the time when his own creation, the ones who were to be his image bearers, would put him to death. Sit with that for a moment, the truth of that for a minute. God knew this from the beginning, from the beginning, from the beginning, that creating in the way that he has was going to lead to his own suffering, and that the whole genesis of human history to the focal point of human history on Jesus, it would all lead to his own suffering. That says something to us, I think, significant about the revelation of who God is. That from the beginning, before the creation of anything, God knew the part of creation made in his image would put him to death. And he would allow it to happen. The amazing thing that you see about Jesus as you read the crucifixion narratives, he doesn't respond to accusations. He doesn't defend himself. He allows himself to go to the cross, takes that upon him. And one of the other beautiful things I think too in coming out of this resurrection season is this. Not only did he allow it to happen, not only did he allow the pinnacle of humanity, the pinnacle of creation to crucify him, but his resurrection, friends, would not be retribution to the people who crucified him, but would be salvation. Sit with that for a minute. Somebody offends you, somebody hurts you, someone kills someone that you love. What do you want to do? Right? You want retribution. You want justice. You want the right or the wrong to be made right. Not Jesus. Jesus, from the beginning, knew this was what he was going to face, allows himself to go to be put to death, and is raised, and the thing that he doesn't do when he's raised is pour out retribution on his enemies, and rather he says, peace, I give to you my peace, I leave with you. Right? He's speaking something different to the world. How many of us, I wonder, would enter into what you know is going to be both a failed from perception, a failed attempt, and cost you everything in your life? How many of us would enter into the greatest pain imaginable? Probably none of us. For Jesus, there's the obvious physical, brutal pain that he experiences that we recounted on Good Friday. Right? There's the beatings that he takes from the soldiers. There's the thorn crowns that's pressed upon his head. There's the flogs that he took upon his back. There's the exhaustion of carrying this cross for a bit. There's the suffocation that comes as his hands and his feet are nailed into that cross. There's the spear and the thorn, or the spear in the side. There's all these physical things. But then there's also, on top of all that, everybody who's doing this to him are his sons and daughters, whether they know him or believe him or trust him or not. They're his created, they're his image bearers. He's betrayed to the utmost. Even the disciples in which he's sown into for a couple years scattered. And so Jesus bears this unbearable weight that we cannot even fathom. And he signed up for it from the beginning. What does this reveal to us about the nature and the character of God? Here's a few ideas. One, I think it communicates to us that God doesn't hold anything back from his creation. God is fully vested in everything that's happening around us. God has taken on flesh and assumed the worst of sufferings to identify with all of the sufferings and to enter into the deepest parts of human pain so that there is no place where God has not went. It reveals to us that God holds nothing back from God's creation. It reveals to us that the love of God for God's creation chooses and causes him to choose the path of suffering. The love that God has for his creation, he's so invested, he will choose to suffer unimaginably so for his creation. In creation, God was and is doing something so great. So God is so vested in this beautiful thing that he's doing in creation. He's so vested in it that it is worth his own suffering. It's worth his own suffering. Perhaps this is why in Romans chapter 8 there's this birth pains or birth pain metaphor. And so for those of you who are parents, for those of you who are born, have born children, or have witnessed childbirth before, this might be a good metaphor for us to use because I don't know this personally, but over the 9 months experience or 10 months experience of a woman carrying a baby, there is incredible discomfort. There is the woman giving over all of herself to this child that she's carrying, and the husband's just like, I went through this a few times. But there's this longing, and there's this, oh, I'm seeing Peter in the back. I'm Peter, buddy. But there's this anticipation that something good is going to come. And so Paul's talking about this, that creation is groaning, it's even in the pains of childbirth, for the sons of God to be revealed. And so are we, we're groaning, there's something within us that longs for us all to be different. And at the end of this time of pregnancy and in utero, when this baby comes forth, it's like this instantaneous joy. I've never experienced it, anything like it. Only 3 times in my life have I experienced anything like it. It was like heaven and earth kissed in the moment. And it was the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced in my life. Beyond words. But this is representative too of the pain that God bears in order to birth something new and to birth something beautiful. But God chooses, friends, God chooses this path of suffering for his creation that has failed him and that has denied him over and over and over. I'm not saying this to guilt trip us. I'm not saying this to make us feel lowly. I'm saying this to elevate the goodness of the heart of who God is. It's amazing that God does this for a creation and a humanity that just doesn't live over most of the time. Throughout this week, here's what one thing I would encourage you to do is just to sit with this question. And I listed it in your bulletin there. So whether it's in home church or maybe in your own devotional time, what does this communicate to you about the nature of God that from the beginning, in God's foreknowledge, God knew what it was going to cost himself in order to bring about salvation, God chose it anyway. What does that reveal about who God is? How does this challenge your understanding of who God is? How does it shape your understanding, your experience of the character of God? And in God's foreknowledge, he chose this. Then we come to verse 24. And there's a transition right here. But, so there's this truth that is given that Peter's speaking, this is what God has given you. This is what you did. But that's not the end of the story. What you did is not the end of the story, because the beginning of the story didn't have to do with you. It had to do with God. And the end of the story doesn't have to do with you. It has to do with God, because it's all based upon God revealed to us in Jesus. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold Now, humanity can do a lot of things, but there's one thing no human being has ever done. No human being has ever been able to avoid death. Death has gripped and will grip all of us. It's actually a very sobering thought. And in the West, one of the things that we try to do is to medicate ourselves in an affordable way from the presence of death or from experiencing any sort of death. When we experience death or hardship or suffering, the first thing that we want to do, and probably rightly so, is to alleviate it. But then it's like we don't want to deal with the fact that there's actually suffering in the world. Like Jane and Brian talked about this morning in that first song that we sang, and in the story that Jane shared. Like, our faith doesn't all mean, like, rainbows and butterflies. Rainbows was the other thing we were looking for, I knew it. Right? It doesn't all mean rainbows and butterflies, but it doesn't mean that it's not good. In the First Peter passage that's a part of the lectionary reading this week, it talks about for the trials that you have suffered in the meantime. There is an acknowledgement that we can't get away from in the Christian faith that we're going to suffer. We're going to suffer from broken bodies, broken minds, broken world, good Lord. Like the world is a broken place. We cannot avoid suffering, but we get from the person of Jesus, we see that God enters into suffering, and so we don't need to fear suffering, right? We don't need to escape suffering, but we can believe, because God has done it, that God enters into suffering with us. And so instead of trying to skirt around it, we can say, God, I welcome you into this. And perhaps that's the posture that the follower of Jesus wants to have in the midst of suffering. Is God, I welcome you into this. Because you know what this is. You chose this for yourself. It was impossible. I love this imagery. And if I was a better artist, I would be able to sketch something out. But this death not being able to grasp a hold of him. I can see death in a metaphorical kind of way, you know, hands trying to grasp onto Jesus and just can't get a hold of him. You know, death cannot grab a hold of Jesus. Death cannot keep Jesus down. What's interesting, and I've said this before, historically, within the church, there's the Eastern Church, there's the Orthodox Church, and the Western Church. And one of the things that the Eastern Orthodox emphasize is that the main enemy of God is death, not sin. And as we read the New Testament, it is dealing with sin, but the main message of the New Testament is this: you can't kill God. It's not just sin. I mean, that's part of it. We got to deal with that. The main message is, you tried to kill God, and you couldn't. He's alive, Jesus is alive, but you tried to destroy the goodness of God, revealed to you in Christ Jesus, the Lord. You can't keep him down. Jesus is alive, it's the resurrection. The message of the New Testament, what the apostles are proclaiming is the resurrection of the dead. What the apostles were proclaiming was that one enemy, that the one enemy that has defeated every human ever created, this is what they're proclaiming, has been defeated. Death has been put to death through the resurrection of Jesus, and the way to a whole new world has opened. Now, in our secular times, we live in a time where the physical and the now and the immediate are the only things that count for anything, and the significance of this has challenged, and in some cases even caused the significance of the resurrection to be downplayed or even just simply ignored, because we think, well, it's just only my imminent life that's happening now, that's the only thing that there is, and so resurrection might be nice talk and all that kind of thing, but it really doesn't have any hold on me or impact on me. Friends, because of Jesus, this very short life that we have here has opened up into an eternity where heaven and earth will be restored, where the plague of sin that plagues every human heart and relationship will be destroyed, where the air we breathe resurrection tells us that this is not all there is. Resurrection opens a way for us into an eternity that's never going to perish. It's not going anywhere. Going again to the verses in 1 Peter. And so, Peter says all of this, and then he begins to quote Psalm 16. Because of the resurrection of Jesus, we can sing, because this is a song, all songs are songs, and we can pray in this way. Now, David didn't know what he was saying. This is part of the beauty of the scriptures, the prophets, David, of whom was one, who writes, and the way that Peter uses this song draws kind of back from this tradition of the people of Israel. David doesn't know what he's saying, but he knows what he's longing for. And so he says this: I saw the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. And so even in the midst of a world around us shaking, God is at our right hand, and we don't need to be shaken. Friends, I truly believe that one of the biggest witnesses of the church, the followers of Jesus, in our day, in our age, when all hell is breaking loose all over the world, is to be steadfast, to be calm, to be people of peace, to be people who aren't going to freak out, but people who can say, because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Verse 26, therefore my heart is glad and my tongue rejoices. My body will also rest in hope. And so in the midst of everything going on in the world, in the midst of waters of violence, in which we curse one another, and all of those things, those who believe in the resurrection of Jesus will rejoice. I don't know if this is an actual phrase, but I made it up for today. This tongue of rejoicing, here's my suggestion, friends, is that we rejoin the world into a world that is not full of joy. We rejoy the world as we are present and stand steadfastly in the love and the worship of Jesus. I want to give that to you as a task. Friends, rejoy the world. Let that be a call. When you show up, rejoy the world. Why? Not because things are good, but because God's good. And because God's going to last forever. This isn't. It'll be renewed. It'll be restored. So let's rejoy it now. Rejoy the world. Verse 27. Because you will not abandon me to the realm of the dead. You will not let your Holy One see you. Friends, death has been put to death, and death no longer has the last word over any of us. And so we can live freely, giving ourselves to the good work of glorying God in the person of Jesus. That can be our life, even if it costs us our life. It doesn't matter, because death doesn't have the last word for any of us. Verse 28, you may know to me the paths of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence. Life has come to us in the person of Jesus. Life has the last word in the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus is still present, friends, among us. Death didn't heal. Death didn't hold him down. Death can't hold us down because we are raised with Christ. I'll hear the last words the Apostle Peter in the passage that's the New Testament reading. Praise be to God, Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, never spoil, never fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In all this, you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, through them, you demonstrate the trust that you have in the steadfastness of God. And all this you greatly rejoice in, and after a little while you have suffered grief and all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, the greater worth than gold, which even perishes though refined by fire, may result in praise and glory and honor in Jesus Christ, the true believer.